Today's presentation then is about what I've called Shell's inherited history in Canada. Normally, when the history of Shell is told, it's about what I'll describe as kind of the mainline Shell. How Shell first came to Canada, how it grew mainly organically. They kind of mention as a sidelight some of the acquisitions that were made. We don't often get into a lot of detail on this. So we are celebrating next year our 100th anniversary in Canada. First came to Canada in 1911 with the establishment of a marketing terminal in Montreal. And as I mentioned to several people, we are currently in the process of converting our refinery in Montreal back into a marketing terminal just as a centennial project. So sort of back to the future thing. Okay, so what I did here is there was an organization that came to Calgary for a meeting last year. It's called International History of Geology. Sort of tied into UNESCO, and they had some sessions up at the University of Calgary. We're looking for speakers, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to do some research and put together a package to sort of explore all the different companies that kind of fed into Shell as it exists today. And as I mentioned in the abstract of the talk that I sent out in archives, can be visualized as a river. You have a number of tributaries that feed into the main river. So just as you have the Assiniboine feeding into the Red River in Manitoba, or the Missouri feeding into the Mississippi or something like that. There are huge histories out there that Shell, in essence, when they acquired these companies, inherited. And one of the motivations I have is for Shell to be able to recognize those histories and, you know, in a way, covet them just as much as they covet their own Shell history internally. And there's certainly lots of things out there in the public that relate to some of these older companies that Shell took over. And unless you knew something about the history, you wouldn't really realize that they had a connection to Shell. Okay. Now, that's what Shell looks like if you looked at one of the Petroleum Monitoring Agency diagrams that used to have back in the bad old days of the National Energy Program and so on. It really doesn't tell you very much other than here's a whole pile of companies and here's what Shell owns in them, but you don't get a sense for what the timing is, where they came from, are they new creations, are they old things that they inherited, and so on. So the trick is to look back into the history and try and find out exactly how it came to be. And this is how some people see Shell's history. Started in 1911, and now we're here, and that's all there is to it. Apparently it's a little bit more complicated. I have given you all a handout there on your table. It's something we call a dynastic chart. And it shows exactly how all the branches came together, all the acquisitions that were made and so on along the way. Shell, as in this diagram here, is a red line through the middle that all the branches coming into the side are what we're going to be talking about today. And I put in all the dates there. It's not scaled exactly accurately, like it wasn't a grid line behind it, but things are more or less in the proper positions there. A little bit of background, Shell was established in 1908 through the merger of the Shell Transport and Trading Company in England and the Royal Dutch Shell Company in Holland. They agreed to pool all of their assets and have joint management of those assets. And then they branched out around the world, merging things that they'd been doing before that. So as I say, Shell Canada was established in 1911, so 1912 on here. And something that's also interesting, just as a side note, is 1911 is when the Standard Oil Trust was broken up in the States. A lot of the history of Shell, especially in the early days, and in fact what led to the merger with Royal Dutch Shell, was this intense rivalry with Standard Oil on a global scale. And that's well described in the prize and Marcus Samuel's biography and all that sort of stuff. So this is just a snapshot of what was happening. Jumping ahead quite a ways, this is what the picture looked like for the ownership of Shell Canada prior to 1963. Stepping back a little bit from that, so you know, Shell Canada itself was mainly an Eastern Canadian operation and mainly a downstream operation. Following the boom that transpired after the Leduc discovery, basically all of the exploration and production activity that occurred in Western Canada was funded by and organized out of the United States. Right? So it wasn't really a Canadian operation in Western Canada, it was a US operation. But in 1957, they decided that they would create an integrated Shell Canada. They merged the two companies together, or the assets and the people and so on together. And in return for that, they gave Shell Oil Company a 50% working interest in Shell Canada. So they then owned a piece of the entire action. In 1963, Shell Oil decided to do something a little bit different, and that is that they took the shares that they had in Shell Canada as an asset, and they dividended them out to their own shareholders. And that was the origins of the public float of shares in Shell Canada, because up to that time there wasn't any actual direct public shareholding in Canada. And it's only over the last 3 years, I guess, that the group has finally come back in, of course, and snapped up the rest of those shares, and Shell in Canada, as it is in the States, is now 100% owned by the Shell. Okay, so when we go to Gasoline Alley, old or new, see a lot of these old historic signs on the wall, a lot of interesting Shell stuff there. But interspersed amongst them, we see signs like White Rose, and Arco, we'll see North Star signs, and so you kind of wonder, did they get a little mixed up when they were putting the signs on the wall, or is there some method to this way of displaying things? Here's what we're going to look at, the main period of creation of Shell as it currently exists right now. That is sort of the late 50s and early 60s. So this is what Shell looked like in the downstream in the late 1950s. They had the Montreal East Refinery. They had the Shelburne Refinery out on the coast. Basically, didn't have anything in Western Canada by way of downstream assets. It certainly had some producing assets. So. And it was time, in their mind, to expand in Canada. They saw Canada as a good place to grow, and so they cast their eye out to companies that would be a good fit with their existing assets. This is the marketing they had. Operations in Western Canada, a little fairly sparse, and then the network in Eastern Canada anchored around the Montreal refinery. They looked around and they found North Star Oil. Now, North Star was a company that was headquartered in Winnipeg, and it had quite an impressive array of marketing terminals and gas stations all across Western Canada. These had been established in Winnipeg all the way back in 1919, and it was sort of originally built around some assets from the Continental Oil Company. Mainly a downstream marketing assets. And so it had a big focus, as it says there, on bulk dealerships and agricultural companies, or customers, I should say. Now, my dad used to work for North Star. That's probably, as I mentioned in the abstract of the talk, that's probably why I have this interest in petroleum history, because I was part of the acquisition of North Star by Shell. Sort of grew up in the early 60s as a Shell grad, so it's somewhere planted in the back of my mind is this Shell and Shell history thing. So North Star had 1,000 service stations, 350 bulk plants, and was a good fit for what Shell wanted to do. These are some of the brands that North Star had in their portfolio. Probably seen around the William Penn Motor Oil cans. So William Penn, of course, was from Pennsylvania. Idea, this was the essence of quality lubricating oils, and they also had Quaker State, which again is a reference to Pennsylvania. So this was just the way you grabbed a name and you promoted your materials back in those days. And they also had something called Falcon Diesel. Falcon was a small company that North Star themselves had bought back in the 30s. The anchor for the North Star network was the St. Boniface Refinery. That had been built in 1920 and had been expanded to about 12,500 barrels a day at the time of the acquisition by Shell. And they produced a wide range of products for the various markets. Now, the owner of Northstar, kind of ironically, was a guy named Fred Manning. He lived in Nova Scotia, and he was an old-time contemporary of the Irving, Casey Irving, who had established, of course, his monopoly on just about every industry under the sun in New Brunswick. But in 1959, Manning passed away, and it was decided as part of his estate that they would find a buyer for the shares, and Shell stepped in with a good offer and picked that up. Northstar had also opened a small refinery in Grand Prairie, Alberta at that time in order to supply local markets. Now, even before that, Northstar had purchased a company called Prairie Cities Oil. That company had been incorporated in Winnipeg in 1912, and it had as its trade logo this Buffalo Oil type of product. And these fantastic collection of Buffalo Oil tins and so on are in one of Ron Carey's showrooms. So Ron, as you all know, is the guy that donated all kinds of stuff to Heritage Park, stocked Gasoline Alley with all signs and so on. So he has a good collection of Buffalo Oil products that are manufactured in Winnipeg. And it was purchased by Northstar in 1938. So it had more than 15 years of history as part of the Northstar organization. And as I say, Buffalo was their trade name. So this is what Northstar looked like in 1960. The directors, first name there, Fred Manning, deceased, and then a number of other names. John Downing, actually, was one of the directors of Northstar. John's a member of the Art Petroleum History Society here in town. So this is just a description of how it happened. The guy on the right here is the president of Shell Oil, or Shell Canada, I guess, at that time. And the guy on the left is one of the wheels in the Northstar organization. Northstar had, before the acquisition though, purchased a small oil and gas company called Cree Oil. Now, this is a bit of a financial statement from Cree Oil. And John Downing had been a principal of this organization as well. And I talked to John several months ago about why they sold out to Northstar, because they had only been established, we'll see that in another slide here, only been established in 1956. And John said, hey, it was money. You know, that's one thing that's kind of ironic about Leduc and all the discoveries that were made in the 50s, is that it was great for the province and everything else, but it was horrible for a lot of companies operating here that wanted to explore and produce, because it was huge overcapacity. And you know, you couldn't raise money to do more exploration. So a lot of people that tried to do that actually ended up going bankrupt. I remember reading in Aubrey Kerr's transcript of his interviews at the Glen Bowl. He sort of fell in with some people, I think from Home Oil or something like that. And that was a very, very difficult time for those guys as well, because basically there was no point in exploring. All the markets were saturated and production had to be prorated according to capacity. And it's pretty tough. So you can see here, there's a deficit at the end of 1957 of almost $1 million for Cree Oil. And one of the interesting connections of Cree Oil is that one of its founding members was Ted Link. Ted Link was the one of the guys that was, of course, at Imperial. He was their chief geologist at the time that the Leduc discovery was made in 1947. So Cree was one of the things that Ted Link got involved with. In the aftermath of Leduc when he left Imperial, but this aspect of it at least didn't turn out so well for him. This is the sort of thing that Cree had when they were purchased by Northstar in 1958, sort of a smattering of land across the Western Basin. You know, the usual trick for small E&P companies to have a diversified portfolio, have your finger in a number of pies, and see what you come up with. All right, the next part of the acquisition story, Northstar came into the fold in 1960. The next big one was Canadian Oil in 1962. Canadian Oil had first been established in 1901 by Petrolia, Ontario, sort of the home of Dave Stock and other luminaries. So it, again, this was a difficult time for the industry, and we'll see on one of these charts and also on your diagram there. Very shortly after it was established, it was forced into a merger with a number of other operators to form Canadian Oils until 1908. Now, 1908 to 1938 have annotated there as the period in which it came under the thumb of the National Refining Company. This was an American company with a trade name Anarco. A lot of the products you see from Canadian Oil had this Anarco logo on them. And this is when Canadian Oil was celebrating its 50th birthday. They put out a really nice volume there with the history from 1908 to 1958. Their first refinery was in Petrolia, so they had a small refinery there. And they upgraded that, and I guess it had a capacity when it was first constructed of 1,500 barrels a day. And here's the list of companies that I've transposed onto the diagram there for you. Some shots of early Canadian Oil marketing. I really like this one in the upper left-hand corner here. This really is very touching to me, given that, you know, Imperial Oil is now charging you to put air in your tires at the gas station if you haven't filled up. It says free air. I actually saw that as a real plus for, you know, automobiles in the early days were starting to have inflatable tires and so on. And this is what a station looked like in New Brunswick back in the 30s. So here's some of the Anarco marketing material. They had this famous character here called the boy with his slate. He always had cute advertising slogans there, and it was a little kind of a newspaper thing that you could pick up a copy of when you went to the gas station. So that's, yeah, they often had all kinds of good and bad advice in there. This is an example of one of their brochures. You can see the listing of all their different gas stations there, advertising for what they offer, and then some kind of interesting graphics as well. And you'll see that White Rose is a trade name that Anarco had for their products. There's a list of a lot of the products that they carried, and you can get a sense sort of from the some of the names on here for the timing that we're dealing with. Spindle oil, thread cutting oil, I guess we still have that, ice machine oil. There's something to do with horses in there someplace too. But, livestock spray, neat squid oil. So yeah, they were trying to cover the entire waterfront here. They're one of the bigger companies in Eastern Canada for sure. So this is what Canadian Oil looked like. At this point, we're looking at the late 40s. Quite a wide range of gasoline outlets in Western Canada. You see they've been experiencing a strong growth in their sales volume over that period of time. In 1958, they had, for example, 250 outlets in Alberta, 182 in Saskatchewan, 172 in Manitoba. They had almost 1,400 outlets in Ontario. They had built a refinery then at Sarnia. There we go right there in 1952, so it was a big state-of-the-art refinery for their network. Modernized their marketing network. Of course, the nature of the gas stations and transportation equipment is always changing. And in Eastern Canada, quite strong there too. Over 600 outlets in Quebec, and almost 400 in the Maritime provinces. And they also had a refinery at Quebec City. So this looked like a good target for Shell again, something that would be a good fit for their organization. Fitting sort of with the quality standards that Shell would have had. And also they had quite a strong foothold in transportation of fuels on the Great Lakes. They had a fleet of ships that carried products up and down the length of the Great Lakes there. In 1955, Canadian Oil had done the same thing that North Star did. North Star bought Cree Oil to diversify into the upstream. Canadian Oil bought Anglo-Canadian. Now, Anglo-Canadian, in contrast to Cree, had a very, very rich history all of its own. It had been, well, we'll get to that in a second, but at the time of the acquisition, it had ownership of 174 wells or 3,000 barrels a day. So it was not a bad little operation on its own. Anglo-Canadian had been formed in Turner Valley back in 1935. So just before the 1936 discovery of oil at Turner Valley. And of course then it was in a position to kind of ride the boom as that happened, and it established a subsidiary called Drilling Contractors in order to cash in on the activity of drilling. And as Turner Valley declined over the years, then Anglo-Canadian branched out into the rest of Western Canada. So it's not uncommon to find Anglo-Canadian assets in Redwater and all these kind of places that go along the main layers there as well. So these are some good pictures about Anglo-Canadian's operation in Turner Valley that come from that book called In the Light of the Flares. It was sort of the history of Turner Valley. It was written, probably about 25 years ago, or
77.
Okay. Yeah, very comprehensive and good look at some of these companies. Canadian Oil, after the acquisition, had made a nice discovery at Innisfail. So when you guys are driving up the Queen Elizabeth Highway there to Edmonton, for some reason or other, you'll pass the Parkland Refinery at Innisfail, just by pulling there. And that's the old Canadian Oil Refinery, which was then Shell Refinery, which was then divested to Parkland. So it used to be part of it. It was anchored by the D3 pool at Innisfail.
Is it still going?
The refinery's still going, yeah. And it's part of the Fast Gas Network of stations. I'm not sure. A lot of times they do product trades here and there. I know they had a problem there because they were dependent on the supply of light condensate coming out of the foothills fields. And when Husky started pouring heavier oil into Jumping Pound gas plant, which started ending up in the Innisfail refinery, they weren't too happy with that. I think they actually intervened against allowing it to happen because it was the implication they'd have to invest a bunch of capital in that refinery in order to be able to cope with that. That change of blend. Okay, so that's what Canadian Oil looked like in 58. You can see again they'd been experiencing a strong growth in reserves and production and land holdings and so on. But Anglo-Canadian itself had a history before that. Anglo-Canadian in the 50s had purchased, in 1953, had purchased Calmont, which was another major player in Turner Valley. Calmont had been established in 1925 by some English capital interests, and by the late 20s was the largest independent operator in Turner Valley. So, I mean, you normally think of Shell, you know, Jumping Pound West, but through this inheritance, Shell actually has a pretty good swag of things that were going on in Turner Valley, both through Anglo-Canadian directly and indirectly by their purchase of Calmont. Okay, so jumping to 1981, this is what Shell looked like at that time. We had Montreal East Refinery, which was our own. We had built a new refinery at Oakville. We had the Sarnia Refinery from Canadian Oil. We had the St. Boniface Refinery from North Star. We had the Bowden Refinery from Canadian Oil, and Shellburn was Shell's own refinery. Now, back in the 80s, of course, with high oil prices and the National Energy Program and all that, there were huge changes in the supply-demand arrangements in Canada, and so it was time for, the belief was, because of the West was going to be so strong economically with new investment, to expand capacity in Western Canada and to cut back on capacity in more Eastern Canada. So what was decided was that they would close the Oakville refinery, they would close the St. Boniface refinery, and they'd build a brand new refinery up in Fort Saskatchewan, which is the Scotford refinery. So So that's sort of how a major change occurred in Shell's refining network as a result of changes in supply and demand. And interestingly, Scotford's the decision to invest at Scotford was partly driven by the expectation of a long period of sustained low natural gas prices. So we've certainly been through some ups and downs on that, but maybe now we're finally seeing that in the flesh. And part of the Scotford investment too was a major chemical manufacturing facility up there. There's a big styrene monomer plant that Shell has. It's not part of Shell Canada's organization anymore. It's still Shell up beside the refinery there at Fort Saskatchewan. So as it stands right now then, in 2002, the Sarnia refinery was the only major piece of hardware that we still have that we got through an acquisition. Other stuff had been rationalized out of the picture. Now, towards the later days, we did make a number of other acquisitions, and this one, Crow's Nest Industries in the Crow's Nest Pass area, was triggered by the desire of Shell to be not just an oil and gas company, but to be an energy company and to get into the coal mining business. So Crow's Nest Industries had some major properties in the Crow's Nest Pass area, in particular some good properties at a place called Lion Creek, which is up the Elk River Valley. And so we bought that in 78, and by the early 80s we were a major coal producing company. I guess until low oil prices made us decide that we in fact are just an oil and gas company, and we divested the Lion Creek mine to, Tech or somebody or other. So we kind of built the thing, and then when Jack McLeod was president, we sort of decided that that was the end of that game for us and got out of it. So that was in 1978, we made that acquisition. In 1987, Shell decided that it would rationalize some of its portfolio again. Stepping back a little bit, in 1972, Shell had farmed out all of its frontier properties and its heavy oil assets like Peace River in a partnership relationship with Shell Oil in the States. Shell Oil was going to contribute $225 million and in return was going to earn a 50% working interest in all of those properties. And that's kind of interesting. All of our drilling in the Mackenzie Delta, all of our drilling in the first phase of the Nova Scotia offshore was all funded out of that $200 million. And so at the end of the day, we sort of got a lot of reserves on the table there without us actually having paid directly for it. But in 1987, given that none of those properties were yet on production and that Shell Oil was sitting there with these huge tax losses, it looked like a good business deal to buy them out and then be able to throw those tax pools into the Shell Canada mix and make some money out of that way. So that's what happened in 1987. 1990, Turbo, which had a refinery just north of Calgary and a marketing network in Alberta and British Columbia, Shell bought those guys out as well. In 2006, we bought a company called BlackRock, which is heavy oil producer, a good synergy there up in the Peace River area with our other heavy oil assets. And of course, you'll all remember fairly recently good old Duvernay and Shell's top dollar purchase of that for the unconventional gas resources in the Groundbirch play up in British Columbia, just in front of the mountains there. So the bottom line here is Shell in Canada has a rich history of acquisitions. It has a lot of history that is inherited from other companies. And I think it's important for those of us that are interested in petroleum history to kind of have the big picture to know where all these things came from and to appreciate, that, for example, from a corporate point of view, we'd be very successful in growing not only organically, but through a series of acquisitions. All right, so that's it.